Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos, hoping everyone had a great 4th of July weekend. Today on The Breakdown, we're revisiting one of our favorite interviews so far this year. In May, we talked with Jennifer Granholm. She was the first woman elected governor of Michigan, and now she's President Biden's energy secretary, pushing the administration's climate change agenda.
She has a lot of experience with the auto industry in Michigan, and now she's been working to overcome resistance to phasing out gas-fueled vehicles to make way for electric cars and helping to sell the president's infrastructure plan, along with its funding for projects like electric charging stations.
And we should say that since we talked with Granholm, a lot has actually changed in the administration's push for an infrastructure investment.
That's right. Biden is now pitching a deal made with a group of Democrats and Republicans that'll spend $1.2 trillion on transportation, broadband, internet, water infrastructure, and more.
They're calling it the largest federal investment ever in public transit, clean drinking water, and electric vehicle infrastructure. And to pay for it, the group has proposed more money for the IRS to crack down on tax avoidance. The question now, can Biden get the 60 votes to pass it? Already we've heard criticism from Democrats on the left that the compromise doesn't go far enough to reshape the economy in the face of climate change. And Granholm will be a key player in making the closing pitch to Congress and the public.
The Senate is now in recess for much of the summer, setting up a legislative sprint to September.
That's right. More than any administration ever, the Biden team is linking infrastructure and jobs with climate change policies and investments. We started by asking Granholm about that strategy and the difficulty in selling that idea.
Actually, it is not a tough sell. I mean, it might have been a tough sell a decade ago, a tougher sell. But you know what the president says? You've seen these commercials, maybe. You know, when I think of climate, I think of jobs. And it's just really true. The whole world, we have 196 countries that have signed on to these Paris agreements because everybody understands the importance of addressing climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And guess what? When you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that means you have to have products that do that work for you. And that means that there is potentially a market out there for those products. And the question is the United States going to get in the game of making those products? So there was a study out earlier this year that said that the market for greenhouse gas reducing products, like whether it's generating clean energy like wind turbines or making sure that industrial processes reduce their carbon emissions, like carbon capture, use and sequestration, those technologies create a $23 trillion global market. So you better believe our economic competitors, other countries, are in the game. They are in it to make sure they create jobs for their people. And the president strongly believes that we should be doing that in the United States. We have stood by too long while we have bowed to the altar of cost, and we haven't invested in our country and in our people and co-partnered with our businesses to create jobs in the United States. So that's what he is determined to do. And this is the fastest growing sector globally. So he's going to make sure that we're in the game.
So that sounds good. And I think It is good for a lot of people. But as you know, there's still pockets of deep resistance. I mean, even here in California, where we've been very ambitious around climate change and investments, you know, the governor got a lot of pushback from the Central Valley when he recently rolled out a plan to not only ban fracking, but move toward banning all oil extraction. So how are you talking to folks in those types of communities? And especially coming from Michigan, where I think you understand, you know, the purple state, the challenges of sort of, you know, that common language that doesn't always exist.
1,000%, 1,000% get it. I mean, you know, I was governor at a time when the auto industry was on its knees, when General Motors and Chrysler were declaring bankruptcy and the suppliers to the auto industry were declaring bankruptcy. And we produced the internal combustion engine, which relies on fossil fuels. And so when we were in the middle of that crisis, and I honestly think this is the reason why the president asked me to lead the Department of Energy, is that we said, look, we built car 1.0, we should be building car 2.0. And that means the electric vehicle, and that means the guts to the electric vehicle, which is the battery. So what's the analogy for fossil fuel workers? They powered this country for over 100 years, and they did right by their families in doing so. And the question is, we want them to see themselves in the future powering of America and being able to make sure that they are part of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. If all of these oil companies are doing that and setting, you know, net zero carbon emissions by 2050 goals like the president has set, well, then why can't we make sure that we do right by these communities? And that means that the president has put forth this intergovernmental working group, it's called, on coal and power plant communities. We've identified 25 communities across the country that have been largely reliant on fossil fuels and that now are really struggling, that are on their knees. And so we want to lift those communities from their knees to make sure that they see that they get the benefit of job creation. So this is why in the American Jobs Plan that the president has put forward, 40% of the benefits of those investments will go to communities that have been left behind, whether they're fossil fuel communities or communities that have lived in the shadows of power plants, like communities of color, et cetera. So the president gets it that we can't leave communities behind and that they should see the benefits of this clean energy economy and this surge toward investment and not be left behind in that either.
Well, and a lot of resistance, of course, comes from big fossil fuel and coal states like West Virginia and Texas and Louisiana. And my understanding is that folks in those communities, they don't believe all this green energy pitch, like, oh, there's going to be a place for you in it, in part because they see the messengers as being sort of coastal elites. Yeah. Who don't know their culture and don't know what their needs are and what their communities are like. So how do you overcome that?
It's true they do see that. And this is why the president is such a great messenger. It's why I hope I can be able to help this coming from a Midwestern state. I completely get how families feel when they've had the rug pulled out from under them for no fault of their own. And so for us to be able to devise strategies that bring job providers to those communities, that is what we are focused on. How can we make sure, for example, in West Virginia, which is a coal mining state, so that's the skills that many of the workers in West Virginia have. And so are there analogous kinds of jobs that would make sense to go into West Virginia? Well, look, lo and behold, it turns out that West Virginia partially, for example, is sitting on a geothermal hotspot. So if you've mined for coal, maybe you can help mine for geothermal. Or maybe we can take a look at having you be part of the move to attach carbon capture, use, and sequestration technology on power plants so that we can reduce and eliminate greenhouse gas emissions off of fossil fuels. So there are technologies that are related to the kinds of skills that are already in these places. And this is why we want to make sure and this is what the American Jobs Act does. It steers investment to communities like that. For example, Joe Manchin, who obviously represents West Virginia as a United States Senator, he's got a bill that's incorporated into the American Jobs Plan, which will make sure that companies who locate in fossil fuel communities, in old industrial communities, get a significant tax credit for locating a manufacturing facility there. So we want to make sure we do all we can policy-wise to attract job providers so that people aren't cynical. It's easy to train people, but if you're training them for for no job, that doesn't make sense. You have to put the job there first and then train people behind it.
All right. So we're talking about on the ground right now, but let's zoom up because you did mention Joe Manchin in Congress. I want to ask you like kind of about the broad politics of this, because it feels like Republicans have been really good at weaponizing the Green New Deal against Democrats in some cases. I know that you just got some criticism from right wing media, especially which then came into mainstream media, over stock options that you owned in a private electric bus company. We see Solyndra still being brought up. How do you deal with kind of the politics of this? Because it has become this right-left issue, which I'm assuming is not the way you all want it to be thought about.
Clearly not. I mean, this is this, honestly, if you poll the individual components, as you know, of the American Jobs Plan, do people want to see investment in infrastructure? Heck yes, they want to see investment in infrastructure. They want better roads and bridges. Do people want to see us invest in the technologies of the future so that we can take them to scale and provide jobs of the future for their children and their grandchildren? Heck yes, they want to see America leading. Do the Americans out there want to see us not lose our manufacturing backbone to competitor nations so that we can be building these products and stamping them made in America and exporting them? Heck yes, Americans want to see that. The individual components of this. Do people want to see broadband universally available for people? Yes, they do. These components are so popular. And so the question is, really, the question revolves around how you pay for it.
All right, don't go away. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED.
I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And today we're talking with Jennifer Granholm. She was the first woman to be elected governor of Michigan. And today she's the Secretary of Energy for the Biden administration. You know, you're very much Secretary Granholm associated with Michigan. But in fact, you were born in Canada. Came to California when you were just, I think, 4 or 5 years old, and your family, I think, settled in Orange County. So tell us about that. We always like to ask our guests about, like, where did they come from? So what was growing up in the OC like?
Well, you know, I didn't grow up in Orange County. I spent a little bit of time there, but my dad was, my dad and my mom moved down for economic opportunity. My dad had a job there, but then we moved to San Jose, and then we moved further north to San Carlos, which is where my mom is right now, as a matter of fact. And I went to school at UC Berkeley as an undergraduate, and then went on to law school. The great state, the Golden State, gave me and my family an opportunity as immigrants here. When I was four, I was brought here, and it's been very good to us. So we're, you know, it's fun to have a leg in two states like that, Michigan and California.
Very different states, of course. Tell us a little bit about your family. I mean, were you expected? I think I read you were the first to go to college. Was politics a conversation point at the dinner table? Like, was this a career path they would have foreseen?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, I was the first in my family to go to college. My dad was raised in this, you know, in a little tiny cottage that was kind of off the grid from his parents who migrated during the Great Depression from Sweden and Norway, and they didn't even have running water. There was no indoor toilet or anything like that. Totally poor. And my mom was born in Newfoundland, who, you know, they call it the Rock off of the East Coast. And they met as tellers in a bank in British Columbia. And then they decided they would move down to California, where they were recruiting people who could be bankers. My mom ended up being a homemaker, and my dad ended up being president of the bank. So
wow.
It, the little bank that he was part of. So it was, for them, this was a great opportunity, but they didn't, my dad was a Republican, my mom sort of went along with him, although she's now flipped to the other side. He passed away last year, but bottom line is we didn't really talk about politics much. But when I went, I went to Berkeley and became aware.
You can't help but become aware of Berkeley, right?
Was that your political awakening, would you say?
It was a great awakening. Honestly, it was really, before I got to Berkeley, I was a little bit aware. I had worked on a presidential campaign before that. But bottom line is, it wasn't in my family's DNA that I would become a governor of Michigan. And people who are listening might think, well, you're right, you're in California. Why would you go to Michigan? And my husband and I met at law school at Harvard. And so he's from Michigan. And so I married Michigan and lived there.
Gotta go there, yeah.
And you did really well there. You became, I think, U.S. attorney in Michigan and then attorney general before becoming governor. But you and your husband have an interesting story because it sounds like he was the one who seemed destined for public office.
He was. In fact, when he was growing up, I mean, he was, he thought he was going to be, either he comes from a big Irish Catholic family. He was either going to be Pope or president, that was it.
Very low expectations in that family,
yes,
I see.
Exactly.
Well, getting married was, that was the end of the Pope dream.
Well, I'll just say that being first gentleman of Michigan was not on his list, but he has been such an amazing partner. He teaches at UC Berkeley now, and he teaches leadership, and he's been such an unbelievable partner to me in this whole effort and to our, of course, our kids and everything. So yeah, it was an unusual turn of fate for him and for me, because I didn't expect to be in that position either, but it's worked out okay.
So I when we were researching this, there was a really interesting interview you gave after leaving office where you both talked about this and that it was challenging to sort of wrap your heads around these role reversals. I'm curious, role reversals, I put in quotes, right? Because obviously, right, women can do anything they want.
Of course.
Have you talked to our vice president and her husband about this at all?
Actually, Dan just had a drink with Doug Emhoff about this, and I'm a friend of Kamala Harris. So yes, over the course of time, in fact, I was part of what is known as Emerge, which you in the Bay Area, or many who are politically aware in the Bay Area, knows trains and helps women to decide to run for office, and then supports them when they're in office. And she was part of that. And so I got to know her back then, before she was even married to Doug. And Dan has had really fun conversation with Doug Emhoff about being second gentleman and what that is. But of course, in the ensuing decades, things have evolved so fast, that I think people, it's not as, hopefully, not as unusual anymore that you would see a woman in charge of having a very important office and then her husband in a supportive role. Hopefully, we'll see a lot more of that. These should not be gender dynamics, right? They should just be based on competency. But that's not often the way our brains work.
Yeah. Marisa and I both have met Doug Emhoff, I think, when Kamala Harris was a senator, and he seems to relish being married to a public figure. What was the toughest part about it for your husband?
I think the toughest part for him was that he had ambition, right? And when we, when I was first elected as Attorney General of Michigan and then as governor, he had his own business. And many of the people that he was consulting to, he had a leadership consulting business, were doing business with the state. And he had to shut that down out of for ethics reasons. You want to make sure that there's no crossover, conflict, anything. And so that decision was hard because he had built up that expertise and that in that work. So I think that was really tough. Now, the flip side, he would say, is that he got the privilege of being sort of the primary parent for our three fabulous kids. He has been such an amazing role model for them. He also now teaches all of this too. So it's been a great life and a great, you know, it's worked out just fine for him. But I think initially there was a lot of, you know, there was issues related to ego and all of that, that he would be very frank about if he were on with us today.
Well, maybe he'll be our next guest. I want to remind our listeners, if you're joining us now, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we are talking with U.S. Energy Secretary and former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. Yeah, I think one of the quotes he had given was how he regretted letting the police, the security detail, like, drive the kids to school, and he fixed that. But let's talk a little bit about Michigan. I mean, you oversaw the state during a very tumultuous economic time. I think a lot of the experience you had there around the auto industry, as you mentioned earlier, is one of the reasons that Joe Biden tapped you for this job. I mean, what were the biggest sort of lessons there in terms of, you know, coming out of the you know, coming into the mortgage meltdown and sort of dealing with all of these differing pressures?
I think the biggest lesson is that you have to steer into the wind, meaning that in Michigan for so long, because we had built this vehicle, and we're known as, you know, the automotive capital of the world, it was difficult for people to imagine diversifying. And so, or, you know, we had talked about diversification, but actually doing it and making sure you acted upon it was not as easy as that. And so having people having us diversify both inside the auto industry, meaning making the electric vehicle, was quite a new step for people, and diversifying outside the auto industry as well, so that we weren't balancing our economic table on one leg. And so, you know, leadership means that you have to tell people some tough truths. And so a lot of the manufacturing jobs that we had done in the past were going away, and we had to tell, you know, parents and their young people that what was good enough for your parents in terms of education will not be good enough for your kids. They've got to go on. They've got to go get a college degree, or they've got to get a certificate. They've got to, you know, learn a trade that has some level of computers or whatever involved, as well as making sure that we had the educational institutions prepared to make sure that they did do certifications. And we had to invest in our community colleges to make sure that all kids were able to get that post-secondary degree. So shifting people's mindset, I think that's the hardest part of it. But it's easier to do, I will say, when you are down, because people see we have to make a change. We're on a burning platform. We have to jump. And this is the direction we've got to go in. So, you know, we made that jump. I mean, things are still challenging, obviously, in the industrial Midwest, but Michigan came out stronger. And a lot of that thanks to the investment by the federal government, the partnership to save the auto industry.
California, as you know, you lived here for so long, is now a very deep blue state. And the disagreements in Sacramento are really between moderate Democrats and more liberal or progressive Democrats. Not so in Michigan. I mean, Michigan is a very purple state, as we saw in 2016. And I'm wondering if you felt you had to make some compromises that you would rather not have made. And I'm thinking, for example, I think you signed a package of bills that were backed by the NRA. Michigan is a big gun state. And there was, I think, a Stand Your Ground bill you signed. I mean, how did you think about those choices and those compromises?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is no doubt that when you are the governor of a purple state, and in this case, the state has a overwhelming the Republican legislature. So I was a Democrat elected as governor, but I had a Republican House and a Republican Senate and a Republican Supreme Court and a Republican Attorney General and a Republican Secretary of State. So I was surrounded by that. And so, as I would say to our team, you know, compromise means that we're moving the ball forward. We can't just say no to everything. However, I will say that I said no to a lot. I used to joke that my favorite four-letter word was veto, and I vetoed more bills than any governor in the history of Michigan as a result of what was coming at me. But it also means that you do have to compromise on at least moving the ball forward. So if you get half a loaf, at least you're able to eat. And then you can go back and get the second half of the loaf later. It's very pragmatic. But when you are surrounded in that way, you have to do compromise.
I'm curious. I mean, as Scott kind of alluded to, Michigan has been in the news so much this past year, from the COVID protests to these credible, really scary threats against the current governor, a Democrat, Gretchen Whitmer. What's it been like watching all of that play out and seeing the state you used to lead just like kind of dominate the news, not in all ways you probably wanted it to?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't dominate the news in the way I wanted to when I was there. We were going through such a recession in the auto industry and all of that. So Michigan is uniquely positioned to have, it looks like, the news focus on it. But yeah, Gretchen Whitmer is a friend. She was in the state legislature when I was governor. And she is wonderful. She's got a ramrod, a strong backbone, and she has been able to navigate this. And because of her, she's very down to earth. She's very pragmatic, and she's just going to tell it like it is. And I think that's why she has very strong popularity. She's supported by the people, even though the gerrymandering in Michigan has left her with a legislature that is Republican. She has been able to withstand, I think, a lot of the onslaught. Now, I will say that there has been a bleeding over of a lot of the, the harsher, conspiracy theorists, et cetera. You saw that she had a lot of people with guns, et cetera, on the steps of the Capitol threatening her. And that goes a step further, certainly, than anything that I ever experienced. And so it is a good thing that she's strong. And I'm hopeful that that wave of sentiment calms down now that we have a new president and one that is interested in unifying and pragmatism and getting jobs for people across America, and instead of interested in dividing people.
Well, as Marisa sort of alluded to, there was this, credible threat to kidnap her and put her on trial. I think it was the Wolverine Watchmen, and the militia groups are quite prevalent in Michigan. What is it about that state, you think, that makes it for fertile territory for that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's not just Michigan, but Michigan has a strong, the militia started in Michigan, or at least there's a very active militia, the Michigan militia group. And it is, there are strands, certainly, of people who are very anti-government. It started in that way. There was a very strong Tea Party movement in Michigan, and that sort of evolved to be this new breed of folks. But I will say, I mean, Michigan has a really strong hunting and fishing culture, really strong outdoors culture, beautiful Upper Peninsula, very unspoiled, where for generations people hunted and with their families, and it's just part of that outdoor culture is part and parcel of Michigan. And so I wouldn't equate just that culture with the extreme versions of that you are seeing on the news.
Well, as you know, we have some of that here in California, too, a very diverse state. All right. We only have about a minute left, and we love to end on a fun note. So we understand that you played the part of Sarah Palin during the 2008 debate prep with then VP candidate Joe Biden. How did you channel your fellow governor and what kind of preparation did it take?
How much fun was
it? You betcha. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I joke that I became a paleontologist. I ended up studying all of her debate prep because she had done a lot of debates as well. She and I served together as fellow governors. She overlapped with us. So I really, you study everything. This time around, for Joe Biden, I was Elizabeth Warren. I was Amy Klobuchar.
Very adaptable.
I was Marianne Williamson even. So I've taken on a lot of these characters.
Did you bring your crystals to that one?
when Sarah Palin walked out and said, "Can I call you Joe?" What did you think?
We got almost everything, but I didn't get that part. We anticipated a lot, but that one we missed.
All right. Well, Jennifer Granholm, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate taking time at such a busy moment back in Washington. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much. It was fun to be on.
You betcha. Okay. And just a reminder, you can find lots more of KQED's politics coverage and analysis in our weekly Political Breakdown newsletter. You can sign up at kqed.org/politicalbreakdown.
And we're always looking for guest ideas, so feel free to email or tweet those over to us anytime.
And that's going to be it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is the great Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tobin-Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Otis Taylor Jr., and Erica Aguilar. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment, and if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. You get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.